We are all faced with a series of great opportunities, brilliantly disguised as unsolvable problems. If we were to take the time to share our problems, as we have already taken the time to share our blessings, I'm afraid we'd be here far after midnight. Because, unfortunately, we are much more focused in on the things that disturb and trouble us than we are with the blessings of God. There are some of you that are facing what you could easily call an unsolvable problem. Without God's wisdom, it is that. With His wisdom, it is a great opportunity. It just depends on your perspective. The problem seems to have no human solution, and perhaps it doesn't. There is no end in view. It has all the marks of an impossible situation. And I have found in my few years on earth that that is the wonderful basis upon which God does His greatest work. The more impossible the situation, the greater God seems to do His work. That was no better illustrated than in the life of Job, a man who, in my opinion, is a living illustration of the things we talked about concerning troubles that don't go away. If you will take the time to turn to the first chapter of Job, you will be at the place where we want to spend some time, along with chapter 2. The book of Job is divided into several sections. Without a doubt, the most familiar part would be the first two chapters, which we have called an introduction to the suffering of Job. The better part of the book is a discussion of the suffering, where Job is surrounded first by his three friends, put friends in italics, by the way, his three friends, and then later on by a fourth man named Elihu, who really was the wisest of the four, though he was the youngest. And that forms what I've called the philosophical section of the book of Job. That is the part where critics seem to land and spend most of their time. But during this particular portion of the book, there's a great series of dialogues on the question of suffering. Is God fair? Is it just? What is a man to learn when he goes through times of suffering? There is not a suffering saint on this earth that is any way familiar with his Bible that has not spent some of his time in the book of Job because of this section especially. And then toward the end of the book, the solution to suffering appears as God addresses himself to Job. And then Job submits under the blows, and finally God relieves him and provides a complete restoration from the suffering. It begins like a narrative and ends that way. There was a man whose name was Job, and so Job died, an old man full of days. It's a story of a man's life. How long the suffering lasted, nobody knows. How old he was when it struck, we don't know. We know how old he was when he died. He was full of years. But as far as the particulars concerning his age and the development of time, we do not know that. Now, we're capitalizing on the first part of the book, which again, I repeat, is a familiar part, and it's five scenes. The third and the fifth scene were the calamitous scenes. And it's upon these scenes we'd like to begin our time as we work our way toward finding out how he handled such terrible, terrible calamities. Look in your Bible, if you will, at verse 6 of chapter 1. And we'll be picking up scene 2. Now the scenes shift from earth to heaven, earth to heaven, earth to heaven, back and forth. Three scenes are on earth. Two scenes are in heaven. The first scene on earth will not read. It's simply a review of Job's home life and his family. And then in scene 2, we are immediately shifted to heaven. And there is quite a scene there. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, Satan also coming among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? Have you taken note of my servant? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. Wow, I wonder what God would say about you if he were to address Satan right now and tell him about your life. Have you considered, and then he calls your name, and then he describes you. I wonder what he would say. With some of you, it might fit very close to what he said about Job, a choice servant of mine. Well, Satan responded, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and his house, and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth thy hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse thee to thy face." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him." You can deal with what he owns, but you can't deal with him. His body, his soul, leave him alone. So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. And I might add, there began the most unprecedented satanic assault that any saint on earth, aside from the Lord Jesus, will ever experience. From the portals of heaven, Satan departed, and he landed upon Job with both feet. Allow me, with some freedom, to be a little bit dramatic, to read the verses that follow. "Now it happened on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, that a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another came and said, 'Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died. And I alone have escaped to tell you.'" Now, frankly, when I read it that way, and I think that must have been the way it happened, one blow after another, after another, after another, before he could breathe in the freedom of some relief, another axe fell. Staggering under the blows of that, he responded in a beautiful way. But before we look at the response, allow me to shift to scene number 5. Will you turn the page? Verse 3. "The Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil.'" And I love this. "And he still holds fast his integrity. Although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. However, put forth thy hand now and touch his bone." And he meant that. "Touch him as deep as you can with disease in his body. Touch his bone and his flesh. He will curse thee to thy face." The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power." What awesome words. "Only spare his life." And Satan went from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Now, frankly, I'm honest with you when I say that I cannot imagine the plight of Job. Thank God I have never known such disease. I have never known such calamity. Neither have most of you. Perhaps it would be safe to say not one of us has ever entered into the depths of misery like Job. How did he respond? What was the answer back to God under the trouble of a loss of everything he owned, home, including family, all of his children, there were 10 of them, and then finally the loss of his health so that he could no longer earn a living, and he became what one would call a drag on society. The picture we see of him in just a few minutes is a lonely, desolate picture as he sits in a dunghill in the land of Uz, scratching his ulcers that were oozing on his skin. What kind of a scene? Look at verse 20 of chapter 1. The first response that Job expressed to God, and I cannot believe it, but I have to, because God said it, was the response of worship. Job arose. You see, after giving him one blow-by-blow account after another account, and finally the loss of all 10 of his children, he must have just sat down and sighed. And after he got it all together in his head, it says that he arose and he tore his robe, which was a descriptive way of illustrating the tearing of his soul. He just ripped his garments, and it said he shaved his head. I wonder how many of us, in portraying Job, would picture a scene with a man with no hair. Isn't it interesting? We don't think of that. But it was as if he were saying to himself and to others, I have lost everything. And in this abject humility, with a shaved head, it says that he fell to the ground and he worshipped. The Hebrew word means to fall prostrate on the ground. That's what it means. It means that he must have slumped to his knees and then just fallen over on his face. It says that he fell to the ground and worshipped. You get that? You would expect it to say he fell to the ground and cried for mercy. Or he asked why, but he didn't. It just says he fell to the ground and worshipped. Dr. Delitzsch, the brilliant linguist of Germany, who has given us such a massive help in exegesis of the Old Testament, has called this word rendered worship the gesture of adoration. Meredith Klein, the splendid scholar of Westminster Seminary, thinking upon this, writes, behold, the wise man Job, not wise because he comprehended the mystery of his sufferings, but because, while not comprehending it, he worshiped God still. In other words, not being able to answer why, he nevertheless worshiped. Worship doesn't come as a result of getting all of one's answers. It comes on the edge of having no answers and saying, God, I adore you still. I praise you in spite of my ignorance and lack of comprehension. I wondered, in your test, which you have been thinking of, if you have ever taken the time out to express the gesture of adoration and to say, Lord, I adore you more than ever in my life, in the midst of this impossible predicament that you have placed me. He worshipped. The second thing I notice is as a response of humility. Verse 21, verse 22. Naked, he says, I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. There's no problem with that. Job didn't have to have things to worship. He had abandoned himself to God. He had no hand in the gourd. He didn't have to have his own will and God's will. God's will was enough. And so he said, Lord, I have come into this life naked. I will go to the next life naked. And so I say to you, you have given and you have taken away. Blessed be your name. You can read the Hebrew, you'd see a play on words between verse 11 and verse 21. Ironically, they are opposite words. In verse 11, it says, he will surely curse you to your face. In verse 21, it says, blessed be the name of the Lord. Both of them, the word Barak. Both of them meaning these thoughts in the context. He's saying, instead of cursing you, Lord, I am saying, blessed be your name. How wonderful it must be in the heart of God to hear from us the opposite of what Satan has accused us of saying. How marvelous an experience it must be before the throne for God to hear words of praise and adoration when the accusing one has said, you do this and you watch him, he will turn from you in a moment. But he didn't. He humbled himself. You see, real love doesn't have to have the trappings of things to be sustained. Your love for your dear wife or your dear husband or your child or your parent doesn't have to have things for it to be there. It goes right on. I watched a television program some time ago, and I heard as a result of a particular earthquake, it was a mudslide, and she had lost everything in the family. My heart went out to them. My wife and I watched the documentary as she stood before the television camera, and she said, my husband and I have lost everything. We have nothing else to live for. And I thought, what a commentary. Without taking away from the calamity for a moment, would you lose everything if you lost your things? Or would that maybe be the beginning of finding yourself? Job didn't have to have things. I was standing with Henry and Barbara Buchanan a number of years ago, 5 minutes after their 19-month-old baby had been pronounced dead. And Henry took me by the arm, and Barbara was standing there with her arms around me, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning at the hospital, and we walked down to the chapel, and we sat down, and Henry said to me, Chuck, let's worship. I don't think I have ever had a better experience of worship than all alone, the three of us, adoring the Father in a fresh way. The Buchanans, like Job, said, blessed be the name of the Lord, and through all of this, they did not sin nor blame God. There is another scene. If you will look at verse 7 of chapter 2, you'll find a response of silence, which is a rare quality in our day. The third response after worship and humility was a response of silence, and it's a pitiful scene. I want you to look at it because you may not have thought through the suffering, the particular ailment of Job. Verse 7, Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, smote Job with sore boils, literally ulcers, skin ulcers. Some have called this black leprosy. Show you why in just a moment. And from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet, he had these terrible ulcers. It's a little bit difficult for Old Testament scholars to define the exact nature of this illness, but they have come to some conclusions from the passages that are in this book, and I'll show you some right now. Verse 8, accompanying the ulcers would be a terrible itching. That's why he scraped himself, and it means to scratch. He was sitting alone in silence, and he was digging away at these sores on his body. Intense itching. Look at chapter 7 and verse 4. Show you a little more of his misery. When I lay down, I say, when shall I arise? But the night continues, and I am continually tossed until dawn. So there was insomnia with the terrible itching. He says, my flesh is clothed with worms. Some believe that even the worms of the body, such as the maggot worm, was present. And a crust of dirt upon him. My skin hardens and runs, he says in verse 5. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and come to an end without hope. Look at chapter 30, please. No, verse 14 before you turn. 7:14. Then thou dost frighten me with dreams and terrify me by visions. That's no laughing matter if you have ever been plagued with nightmares. This man, when he did sleep, was plagued with the unrest of nightmares. Can you imagine the itching, the pain, the running sores, the worms, the insomnia, and when sleep did come, it came in a restless way with nightmares. Chapter 30 is yet another description of the illness. Verse 16. 30:16. And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have seized me. At night it pierces my bones. You remember I said Satan meant what he said when he said his bone? His bones pained within him. My gnawing pains take no rest, so he had unending pain. By a great force my garment was distorted. It binds me about as the collar of my coat. Verse 30. My skin turns black on me, and my bones burn with fever. I am not a doctor and I'm not a nurse, but I think if I were a person of medicine, I could maybe enter more than I do right now into the affliction of that man. Raging fever, tossless, turning nights, heaped upon the pain and the running sores of the body. And let me show you just something else in passing. Chapter 19, verse 17. I bet you never saw this in your life. 19:17 says, even his breath was offensive. Look at that. You ever seen that? My breath is offensive to my wife. Now, how you use that verse, I don't care. But I'm showing you that that has reference to the stench of death that poured from his mouth. Wrap all of that together in your mind and go back to chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, and realize the silence that Job experienced. No doubled up fist shaking it in the face of God, saying, how dare you touch me in my righteous condition? He just silently sat in that heap with no hair, body racked with pain, and he scratched the sores. I'll tell you, that is misery. And then his wife came. Ah, Mrs. Job. Ah. You sometimes wonder about the plan of God, don't you? His wife said to him, verse 9, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. What counsel was that? That was the counsel of Satan. Satan said, if you do this to him, he will curse you to your face. Chrysostom has asked, why did the devil leave him with his wife? Then he answers, because he thought her a good scourge by which to plague him more acutely than any other means. Unquote. Wives, your counsel to your husband is far more significant than you will ever realize. In many ways, you set the pace for his work world. In many ways, you set the arrangement of his mental thinking through the day as he leaves your home and leaves you there. And this unwise woman said, look, Job, curse God and die. She's the only one that suggested suicide. It apparently never entered his mind from here on out. And Job responds with a response of acceptance. Verse 10. Look at that verse. He said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He had worshipped, he had humbled himself, he had sat in silence, and now he says to his wife, wife, I accept what God has sent. I have accepted good. Now I accept adversity. No poet has thrilled my heart like Amy Carmichael. For some reason, she is able to put her finger on the feelings that well up within me and I cannot express in my own words. And so I turn to her to express through a part of her poem that I have put in the first person the words I feel for Job at this moment where he says, I accept what God has sent. I said, I will forget the dying faces, the empty places, they shall be filled again. O voices moaning deep within me, cease. But vain the word, vain, vain, not in forgetting, lieth peace. I said, I will crowd action upon action. The strife of factions shall stir and sustain. O tears that drown the fire of manhood, cease. But vain the word, vain, vain. Not in action lieth peace. Then I said, I will accept the breaking sorrow, which God tomorrow will to me explain. Then did the turmoil deep within me cease. Not vain the word, not vain. For in acceptance lieth peace. You see? Job says, I accept it. Therein is the secret of his stability. I find three very real reasons Job could respond like this, and I share them in closing without even turning. First of all, he looked up and was comforted by God's sovereignty. When he looked up, he saw a God that gave and took away. But he saw more than the actions of the God that gave and took away. He saw the heart of God. He saw the sovereign love of God. And he says to his wife, should we not receive both without question? He looked up and he was comforted by God's sovereignty. I used to fear God's sovereignty, frankly. I used to think it was the work of a great deity that I could call sort of a brute that lived in heaven and swatted us around. But I don't see it that way. I see the loving hand of God moving and pressing and squeezing and turning and twisting until he gets us into that marvelous conformity of his Son and moves us on. I see that now. I identify with Job. The second thing I notice of Job is that he looked ahead and was reminded of God's promise. If you were to take the time to study the book, you would see where he looked ahead. Chapter 19 says, Job responded, oh, that my words could be written with an iron stylus and put into a book. I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that at the last day he shall stand upon this earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see and not another. He was reminded of God's promise that at the end it will all be made right. And that spurred him on by looking ahead. The third area, I would say, is that he looked within and was shaped by God's instruction. Chapter 42, he says that he looked at his life and he repented in dust and ashes. He looked within and he saw that God had instructed him in his suffering and illness as in no other way. And he said, Lord, for the first time, I honestly can say, I give myself to you as never before. If we were to take the time to look into a portion of the scriptures in Jeremiah, we would find a part that talks about our being the clay and God's being the potter. And in the middle of that great 18th chapter, God says, do I not have the right to do with this vessel as I please? The answer implied is absolutely. And I've thought of that many times as I've considered my life and the life of many of God's children, especially when suffering comes. I thought, he has the right. But he wants us to give him, willingly, the reminder that he has that right. It may be a dangerous thing for a sinner to fall into the hands of an angry God. It's a risky thing for a saint to give himself to a sovereign God. But I think perhaps some of you need to do that. You have been fighting and rebelling and working at it long enough. I think in the terms of this person who wrote it this way, Lord, I am willing to receive what thou givest. I am willing to lack what thou withholdest. I am willing to relinquish what thou takest. I am willing to suffer what thou inflictest. I am willing to be what thou requirest. Lord, I'm willing. Are you willing? Really willing? Or does God have a fight on his hands? You may utter those words, but down deep in your soul, you know there are those hidden reservations that say, I want my comfort. I want things kept intact. I want things my way. I don't want things your way, Lord, because it means pain. It means being forgotten. It means being misused. It means being walked on, perhaps. It means accepting what my flesh doesn't want. What if God moved in on you like he did on Job? How would you respond? If you can, in honesty, sing this, then do so.
Thine own way, Lord, have thine.